but in my ignorance had thought that there was little difference between being hanged as an outlaw and executed as a traitor. Monsieur Fauré's visit had taken care of that bit of naivety.
"You're bloody calm about it," I said.
My own heart was still thumping erratically, and my palms were cold but sweaty. I wiped them on my gown and tucked them between my knees to warm them. Jamie shrugged slightly and gave me a lopsided smile.
"Well, there's the hell of a lot of unpleasant ways to die, Sassnach. And if one of them should fall to my lot, I wouldn't like it much. But the question is, am I scared enough of the possibility that I would stop what I'm doing to avoid it?"
He sat down on the chaise beside me and took one of my hands between his own. His palms were warm, and the solid bulk of him next to me was reassuring.
"I thought that over for some time, Sassnach, in those weeks at the Abbey while I healed. And again, when we came to Paris. And again, when I met Charles Stuart."
He shook his head, bent over our linked hands.
"Aye, I can see myself standing on a scaffold. I saw the gallows at Wentworth. Did I tell you that?"
"No. No, you didn't." He nodded, eyes gone blank in remembrance.
"They marched us down to the courtyard, those of us in the condemned cell, and made us stand in rows on the stones to watch an execution. They hanged 6 men that day, men I knew. I watched each man mount the steps, 12 steps there were, and stand, hands bound behind his back, looking down at the yard as they put the rope around his neck. And I wondered then how I would manage come my turn to mount those steps. Would I weep and pray like John Sutter? Or could I stand straight like Willie MacLeod and smile at a friend in the yard below?"
He shook his head suddenly, like a dog flinging off drops of water, and smiled at me a little grimly.
"Anyway, Monsieur Fauré didna tell me anything I hadna thought of before. But it's too late, my dunya."
He laid a hand over mine.
"Aye, I'm afraid. But if I would not turn back for the chance of home and freedom, I shall not do it for fear. No, my dunya, it's too late."
Chapter 24. The Bois de Boulogne. Monsieur Fauré's visit proved merely to be the first of a series of unusual disruptions.
"There is an Italian person downstairs, madame," Magnus informed me. "He would not give me his name."
There was a pinched look about the butler's mouth. I gathered that if the visitor wouldn't give his name, he had been more than willing to give the butler a number of other words. That, coupled with the Italian person designation, was enough to give me a clue as to the visitor's identity, and it was with relatively little surprise that I entered the drawing-room to find Charles Stuart standing by the window. He swung about at my entrance, hat in his hands. He was plainly surprised to see me. His mouth dropped open for a second, then he caught himself and gave me a quick, brief bow of acknowledgement.
"Milord Brochturach is not at home," he inquired.
His brows drew together in displeasure.
"No, he isn't," I said. "Will you take a little refreshment, Your Highness?"
He looked around the richly appointed drawing-room with interest, but shook his head. So far as I knew, he had been in the house only once before, when he had come over the rooftops from his rendezvous with Louise. Neither he nor Jamie had thought it appropriate for him to be invited to the dinners here. Without official recognition by Louis, the French nobility scorned him.
"No, I thank you, Madame Fraser. I shall not stay. My servant awaits outside, and it is a long ride to return to my lodgings. I wish only to make a request of my friend James."
Well, I'm sure that my husband would be happy to oblige Your Highness, if he can," I answered cautiously, wondering just what the request was. "Alone, probably. Fergus's gleanings of late had included quite a number of impatient letters from tailors, bootmakers, and other creditors."
Charles smiled, his expression altering to one of surprising sweetness.
I know. I cannot tell you, madame, how greatly I esteem the devotion and service of your husband. The sight of his loyal face warms my heart amid the loneliness of my present surroundings.
Oh, I said.
It is not a difficult thing, I ask, he assured me. It is only that I have made a small investment, a cargo of bottled port.
Really?
I said.
How interesting.
Murtaugh had left for Lisbon that morning, vials of nettle juice and madder root in his pouch.
It is a small thing.
Charles flipped a lordly hand, disdaining the investment of every cent he had been able to borrow.
But I wish that my friend James shall accomplish the task of disposing of the cargo once it shall arrive. It is not appropriate, you know.
And here he straightened his shoulders and elevated his nose just a trifle, quite unconsciously.
For a person such as myself to be seen to engage in trade.
Yes, I quite see, Your Highness, I said, biting my lip. I wondered whether he had expressed this point of view to his business partner, Saint-Germain, who undoubtedly regarded the young pretender to the Scottish throne as a person of less consequence than any of the French nobles who engaged in trade with both hands whenever the chance of profit offered.
"Is Your Highness quite alone in this enterprise?" I inquired innocently.
He frowned slightly. "No, I have a partner, but he is a Frenchman. I should much prefer to entrust the proceeds of my venture to the hands of a countryman. Besides," he added thoughtfully, "I have heard that my dear James is a most astute and capable merchant. It is possible that he might be able to increase the value of my investment by means of judicious sale."
I supposed whoever had told him of Jamie's capability hadn't bothered to add the information that there was probably no wine merchant in Paris whom Saint-Germain more disliked. Still, if everything worked out as planned, that shouldn't matter. And if it didn't, it was possible that Saint-Germain would solve all of our problems by strangling Charles Stuart, once he found out that the latter had contracted delivery of half his exclusive Gosto's port to his most hated rival.
I'm sure that my husband will do his utmost to dispose of Your Highness's merchandise to the maximum benefit of all concerned, I said, with complete truth.
His Highness thanked me graciously, as befitting a prince accepting the service of a loyal subject. He bowed, kissed my hand with great formality, and departed with continuing protestations of gratitude to Jamie.
Magnus, looking dourly unimpressed by the royal visit, closed the door upon him. In the event, Jamie didn't come home until after I had fallen asleep, but I told him over breakfast of Charles' visit and his request.
"Good. I wonder if His Highness will tell the Comte," he said.
Having ensured the health of his bowels by disposing of his porridge in short order, he proceeded to add a French breakfast of buttered rolls and steaming chocolate on top of it. A broad grin spread across his face in contemplation of the Comte's reaction as he sipped his cocoa.
"I wonder, is it laissez majesty to hammer an exiled prince?"
For if it's not, I hope His Highness has Sheridan or Balholde close by when Saint-Germain hears about it.
Further speculation along these lines was curtailed by the sudden sound of voices in the hallway. A moment later, Magnus appeared in the door, a note borne on his silver tray.
"Your pardon, milord," he said, bowing. "The messenger who brought this desired most urgently that it be brought to your attention at once."
Brows raised, Jamie took the note from the tray, opened, and read it.
"Oh, bloody hell,"
he said in disgust.
"What is it?"
I asked.
"Not word from Murtaugh already."
He shook his head.
"No, that's from the foreman of the warehouse."
"Trouble at the docks." An odd mixture of emotions was visible on Jamie's face, impatience struggling with amusement.
"Well, not precisely. The man's got himself into a coil at a brothel, it seems.
he humbly begs my pardon.
He waved ironically at the note.
But hopes I'll see fit to come round and assist him. In other words, he translated, crumpling his napkin as he rose, will I pay his bill?
Will you?
I said, amused. He snorted briefly and dusted crumbs from his lap. I suppose I'll have to, unless I want to supervise the warehouse myself, and I haven't time for that.
His brow creased as he mentally reviewed the duties of the day. This was a task that might take some little time, and there were orders waiting on his desk, ship's captains waiting on the docks, and casks waiting in the warehouse.
"I'd best take Fergus wi' me to carry messages," he said, resigned. "He can maybe go to Montmartre wi' a letter if I'm too short of time."
"Kind hearts are more than coronets," I told Jamie, as he stood by his desk, ruefully flipping through the impressive pile of waiting paperwork.
"Oh, aye," he said. "And whose opinion is that?"
"Alfred Lord Tennyson, I think," I said. "I don't believe he's come along yet, but he's a poet. Uncle Lamb had a book of famous British poets. There was a bit from Burns in there, too, I recall. He's a Scot," I explained. "He said, freedom and whisky gang together." Jamie snorted.
"I canna say if he's a poet, but he's a Scot at least."
He smiled then, and bent to kiss me on the forehead.
"I'll be home to my supper, my dunya. Keep you well."
I finished my own breakfast and thriftily polished off Jamie's toast as well, then waddled upstairs for my morning nap. I had had small episodes of bleeding since the first alarm, though no more than a spot or two, and nothing at all for several weeks. Still, I kept to my bed or the chaise as much as possible, only venturing down to the salon to receive visitors or to the dining room for meals with Jamie. When I descended for lunch, though, I found the table laid for one.
"Milor hasn't come back yet?"
I asked in some surprise. The elderly butler shook his head.
"No, milady."
"Well, I imagine he'll be back soon. Make sure there's food waiting for him when he arrives." I was too hungry to wait for Jamie. The nausea tended to return if I went too long without eating. After lunch, I lay down to rest again. Conjugal relations being temporarily in abeyance, there wasn't that much one could do in bed, other than read or sleep, which meant I did quite a lot of both. Sleeping on my stomach was impossible, sleeping on my back uncomfortable, as it tended to make the baby squirm. Consequently, I lay on my side, curling around my growing abdomen like a cocktail shrimp round a caper. I seldom slept deeply, but tended rather to doze, letting my mind drift to the gentle, random movements of the child. Somewhere in my dreams, I thought I felt Jamie near me, but when I opened my eyes, the room was empty, and I closed them again, lulled as though I, too, floated weightless in a blood-warm sea. I was wakened at length, somewhere in the late afternoon, by a soft tap on the bedroom door.
"Entrez,"
I said, blinking as I came awake. It was the butler, Magnus, apologetically announcing more visitors.
"It is the Princess de Rouen, madame," he said. "The princess wished to wait until you wakened. But when Madame d'Arbonville also arrived, I thought perhaps..."
"That's all right, Magnus," I said, struggling upright and swinging my feet over the side of the bed. "I'll come down." I looked forward to the visitors. We had stopped entertaining during the last month, and I rather missed the bustle and conversation, silly as much of it was. Louise came frequently to sit with me and regale me with the latest doings of the court, but I hadn't seen Marie d'Arbonville in some time. I wondered what brought her here today. I was ungainly enough to take the stairs slowly, my increased weight jarring upward from the soles of my feet on each step. The panelled door of the drawing-room was closed, but I heard the voice inside clearly.
"Do you think she knows?"
The question, asked in the lowered tones that portended the juiciest of gossip, reached me just as I was about to enter the drawing-room. Instead, I paused at the threshold, just out of sight. It was Marie d'Arbonville who had spoken. Welcome everywhere because of her elderly husband's position, and gregarious even by French standards, Marie heard everything worth hearing within the environs of Paris.
"Does she know what?"
The reply was Louise's. Her high, carrying voice had the perfect self-confidence of the born aristocrat, who doesn't care who hears what.
"Oh, you haven't heard!"
Marie pounced on the opening like a kitten, delighted to find a new mouse to play with.
"Goodness!
Of course I only heard myself an hour ago."
"And raced directly over here to tell me about it," I thought.
"Whatever it was."
I thought I stood a better chance of hearing the unexpurgated version from my position in the hallway.
"It is my Lord Bordeaux," Marie said.
And I didn't need to see her to imagine her leaning forward, green eyes darting back and forth, snapping with enjoyment of her news.
"Only this morning he challenged an Englishman to a duel. Over a whore."
"What?" Louise's cry of astonishment drowned out my own gasp. I grabbed hold of a small table and held on, black spots whirling before my eyes as the world came apart at the seams.
"Oh, yes," Marie was saying. "Jacques Vincent was there. He told my husband all about it. It was in that brothel down near the fish market. Imagine going to a brothel at that hour of the morning. Men are so odd. Anyway, Jacques was having a drink with Madame Elise, who runs the place, when all of a sudden there was the most frightful outcry upstairs and all kinds of thumping and shouting."
She paused for breath and dramatic effect, and I heard the sound of liquid being poured.
"So Jacques, of course, raced to the stairs. Well, that's what he says, anyway. I expect he actually hid behind the sofa. He's such a coward. And after more shouting and thumping, there was a terrible crash, and an English officer came hurtling down the stairs, half undressed, with his wig off, staggering and smashing into the walls. And who should appear at the top of the stairs, looking like the vengeance of God, but our own Petit James?
No.
And I would have sworn he was the last.
But go on. What happened then?"
A teacup chimed softly against its saucer, followed by Marie's voice, released by excitement from the modulations of secrecy.
"Well, the man reached the foot of the stairs, still on his feet, by some miracle, and he turned at once and looked up at Lord Turach. Jacques says the man was very self-possessed for someone who'd just been kicked downstairs with his breeches undone. He smiled, not a real smile, you know, the nasty sort, and said, 'There's no need for violence, Fraser. You could have waited for your turn, surely. I should have thought you get enough at home. But then, some men derive pleasure from paying for it.'"
Louise made shocked noises.
"How awful! The canaille! But, of course, it is no reproach to Milord Durer."
I could hear the strain in her voice as friendship warred with the urge to gossip. Not surprisingly, gossip won.
"Milord Durer cannot enjoy his wife's favours at the moment. She carries a child, and the pregnancy is dangerous. So, of course, he would relieve his needs at a brothel. What gentleman would do otherwise? But go on, Marie. What happened then?"
"Well..."
Marie drew breath as she approached the high point of the story.
"Milord Turach rushed down the stairs, seized the Englishman by the throat, and shook him like a rat."
"Non, ce n'est pas vrai."
"Oh, yes. It took three of Madame's servants to restrain him. Such a wonderful big man, isn't he? So fierce-looking."
"Yes, but then what?"
"Oh, well, Jacques said the Englishman gasped for a bit, then straightened up and said to me, 'Lord Turach, that's twice you've come near killing me, Fraser. Some day you may succeed.' And then me Lord Turach cursed in that terrible Scottish tongue. I don't understand a word, do you? And then he wrenched himself free from the men holding him, struck the Englishman across the face with his bare hand.
Louise gasped at the insult, and said,
"Tomorrow's dawn will see you dead."
Then he turned about and ran up the stairs, and the Englishman left.
John said he looked quite white. No wonder. Just imagine.
I imagined all right.
"Are you well, madame?"
Magnus's anxious voice drowned out Louise's further exclamations. I put out a hand, groping, and he took it at once, putting his other hand under my elbow in support. "No, I'm not well. Please, tell the ladies." I waved weakly toward the drawing room.
"Of course, madame, in a moment, but now let me see you to your chamber. This way, chère madame."
He led me up the stairs, murmuring consolingly as he supported me. He escorted me to the bedroom chaise, where he left me, promising to send up a maid at once to attend me. I didn't wait for assistance. The first shock passing, I could navigate well enough, and I stood and made my way across the room to where my small medicine box sat on the dressing table. I didn't think I was going to faint now, but there was a bottle of spirits of ammonia in there that I wanted handy, just in case. I turned back the lid and stood still, staring into the box. For a moment, my mind refused to register what my eyes saw. The folded white square of paper, carefully wedged upright between the multicoloured bottles. I noted, rather abstractedly, that my fingers shook as I took the paper out. It took several tries to unfold it.
"I am sorry."
The words were bold and black, the letters carefully formed in the centre of the sheet, the single letter J written with equal care below. And below that, two more words, these scrawled hastily, done as a postscript of desperation. "I must."
"You must,"
I murmured to myself, and then my knees buckled. Lying on the floor, with the carved panels of the ceiling flickering dimly above, I found myself thinking that I had always heretofore assumed that the tendency of 18th-century ladies to swoon was due to tight stays. Now, I rather thought it might be due to the idiocy of 18th-century men. There was a cry of dismay from somewhere nearby, and then helpful hands were lifting me, and I felt the yielding softness of the wool-stuffed mattress under me, and cool cloths on my brow and wrists, smelling of vinegar. I was soon restored to what senses I had, but strongly disinclined to talk. I reassured the maids that I was, in fact, all right, shooed them out of the room, and lay back on the pillows, trying to think. It was Jack Randall, of course, and Jamie had gone to kill him. That was the only clear thought in the morass of whirling horror and speculation that filled my mind. Why, though? What could have made him break the promise he had made me? Trying to consider carefully the events Marie had related, third hand as they were, I thought there had to have been something more than just the shock of an unexpected encounter. I knew the captain, knew him a great deal better than I wanted to. And if there was one thing of which I was reasonably sure, it was that he wouldn't have been purchasing the usual services of a brothel. The simple enjoyment of a woman wasn't in his nature. What he enjoyed, needed, was pain, fear, humiliation. These commodities, of course, could also be purchased, if at a somewhat higher price. I had seen enough in my work at L'Hôpital des Anges to know that there were les poutins, whose chief stock in trade lay not between their legs, but in strong bones overlaid with expensive, fragile skin that bruised at once, and showed the marks of whips and blows. And if Jamie, his own fair skin scarred with the marks of Randall's favour, had come upon the captain, enjoying himself in similar fashion with one of the ladies of the establishment, that, I thought, could have carried him past any thought of promises or restraint. There was a small mark on his left breast, just below the nipple, a tiny whitish pucker where he had cut from his skin the branded mark of Jonathan Randall's heated signet ring. the rage that had led him to suffer mutilation rather than bear that shameful mark could easily break forth again, to destroy its inflictor and his hapless progeny. "Frank," I said, and my left hand curled involuntarily over the shimmer of my gold wedding ring. "Oh, dear God, Frank!" For Jamie, Frank was no more than a ghost, the dim possibility of a refuge for me in the unlikely event of necessity. For me, Frank was the man I had lived with, had shared my bed and body with, had abandoned, at the last, to stay with Jamie Fraser. "I can't," I whispered to the empty air, to the small companion who stretched and twisted lazily within me, undisturbed by my own distress. "I can't let him do it." The afternoon light had faded into the grey shades of dusk, and the room seemed filled with all the despair of the world's ending. "Tomorrow's dawn will see you dead." There was no hope of finding Jamie tonight. I knew he wouldn't return to the Rue Trimoulin. He wouldn't have left that note if he were coming back. He could never lie beside me through the night, knowing what he intended doing in the morning. No, he had undoubtedly sought refuge in some inn or tavern, there to ready himself in solitude for the execution of justice that he had sworn. I thought I knew where the place of execution would be. With the memory of his first duel strong in his mind, Jamie had shorn his hair in preparation. The memory would have come to him again, I was sure, when choosing a spot to meet his enemy. The Bois de Boulogne, near the path of the Seven Saints. The Bois was a popular place for illicit duels, its dense growth sheltering the participants from detection. Tomorrow, one of its shady clearings would see the meeting of Jamie Fraser and Jack Randall. And me. I lay on the bed, not bothering to undress or cover myself, hands clasped across my belly. I watched the twilight fade to black, and knew I wouldn't sleep tonight. I took what comfort I could in the small movements of my unseen inhabitant, with the echo of Jamie's words ringing in my ears. "Tomorrow's dawn will see you dead." The Bois de Boulogne was a small patch of almost virgin forest, perched incongruously on the edge of Paris. It was said that wolves as well as foxes and badgers were still to be found lurking in its depths, but this story did nothing to discourage the amorous couples that dallied under the branches on the grassy earth of the forest. It was an escape from the noise and dirt of the city, and only its location kept it from becoming a playground for the nobility. As it was patronized largely by those who lived nearby, who found a moment's respite in the shade of the large oaks and pale birches of the Bois, and by those from farther away who sought privacy. It was a small wood, but still too large to quarter on foot, looking for a clearing large enough to hold a pair of duelists. It had begun to rain during the night, and the dawn had come reluctantly, glowing sullen through a cloud-dark sky. The forest whispered to itself, the faint patter of rain on the leaves blending with the subdued rustle and rub of leaf and branches. The carriage pulled to a stop on the road that led through the Bois, near the last small cluster of ramshackle buildings. I had told the coachman what to do. He swung down from his seat, tethered the horses, and disappeared among the buildings. The folk who lived near the Bois knew what went on there. There couldn't be that many spots suitable for dueling. Those there were would be known. I sat back and pulled the heavy cloak tighter around me, shivering in the cold of the early dawn. I felt terrible, with the fatigue of a sleepless night dragging at me, and the leaden weight of fear and grief resting in the pit of my stomach. Overlying everything was a seething anger that I tried to push away, lest it interfere with the job at hand. Kept creeping back, though, bubbling up whenever my guard was down, as it was now. How could he do this? My mind kept muttering in a cold fury. I shouldn't be here. I should be home, resting quietly by Jamie's side. I shouldn't have to be pursuing him, preventing him, fighting both anger and illness. A nagging pain from the coach ride knotted at the base of my spine. Yes, he might well be upset. I could understand that. But it was a man's life at stake, for God's sake. How could his bloody pride be more important than that? And to leave me with no word of explanation. To leave me to find out from the gossip of neighbours what had happened. You promised me, Jamie, damn you, you promised me, I whispered under my breath. The wood was quiet, dripping and mist-shrouded. Were they here already? Would they be here? Was I wrong in my guess about the place? The coachman reappeared, accompanied by a young lad, perhaps 14, who hopped nimbly up on the seat beside the coachman and waved his hand, gesturing ahead and to the left. With a brief crack of the whip and a click of the tongue, the coachman urged the horses into a slow trot, and we turned down the road into the shadows of the wakening wood. We stopped twice, pausing, while the lad hopped down and darted into the undergrowth, each time reappearing within a moment or two, shaking his head in negation. The third time he came tearing back, the excitement on his face so evident that I had the carriage door open before he got near enough to call out to the coachman. I had money ready in my hand. I thrust it at him, simultaneously clutching at his sleeve, saying, "Show me where! Quickly! Quickly!" I scarcely noticed either the clutching branches that laced across the path, nor the sudden wetness that soaked my clothing as I brushed them. The path was soft with fallen leaves, and neither my shoes nor those of my guide made any sounds as I followed the shadow of his ragged, damp-spotted shirt. I heard them before I saw them. They had started. The clash of metal was muffled by the wet shrubbery, but clear enough nonetheless. No birds sang in the wet dawn, but the deadly voice of battle rang in my ears. It was a large clearing, deep in the bois, but accessible by path and road, large enough to accommodate the footwork needed for a serious duel. They were stripped to their shirts, fighting in the rain, the wet fabric clinging, showing the outline of shoulder and backbone. Jamie had said he was the better fighter. He might be. But Jonathan Randall was no mean swordsman either. He wove and dodged, lithe as a snake, sword striking like a silver fang. Jamie was just as fast, amazing grace in such a tall man, light-footed and sure-handed. I watched, rooted to the ground, afraid to cry out for fear of distracting Jamie's attention. They spun in a tight circle of stroke and parry, feet touching lightly as a dance on the turf. I stood stock still, watching. I had come through the fading night to find this, to stop them. And having found them, now I couldn't intervene for fear of causing a fatal interruption. All I could do was wait to see which of my men would die. Randall had his blade up and in place to deflect the stroke, but not quickly enough to brace it against the savagery that sent his sword flying. I opened my mouth to scream. I had meant to call Jamie's name, to stop him now, in that moment's grace between the disarming of his opponent and the killing stroke that must come next. I did scream, in fact, but the sound emerged weak and strangled. As I had stood there, watching, the nagging pain in my back had deepened, clenching like a fist. Now I felt a sudden breaking somewhere, as though the fist had torn loose what it held. I groped wildly, clutching at a nearby branch. I saw Jamie's face, set in a sort of calm exultance, and realized that he could hear nothing through the haze of violence that enveloped him. He would see nothing but his goal until the fight was ended. Randall, retreating before the inexorable blade, slipped on the wet grass and went down. He arched his back, attempting to rise, but the grass was slippery. The fabric of his stock was torn, and his head was thrown back, dark hair rain-soaked, throat exposed like that of a wolf begging mercy. But vengeance knows no mercy, and it wasn't the exposed throat that the descending blade sought. Through a blackening mist, I saw Jamie's sword come down, graceful and deadly, cold as death. The point touched the waist of the doeskin breeches, pierced and cut down in a twisting wrench that darkened the fawn with a sudden flood of black-red blood. The blood was a hot rush down my thighs, and the chill of my skin moved inward toward the bone. The bone where my pelvis joined my back was breaking. I could feel the strain as each pain came on, a stroke of lightning flashing down my backbone to explode and flame in the basin of my hips, a stroke of destruction leaving burned and blackened fields behind. My body, as well as my senses, seemed to fragment. I saw nothing, but couldn't tell whether my eyes were open or closed. Everything was spinning dark, patched now and then with the shifting patterns you see at night as a child, when you press your fists against shut eyelids. The raindrops beat on my face, on my throat and shoulders. Each heavy drop struck cold, then dissolved into a tiny warm stream coursing across my chilled skin. The sensation was quite distinct, apart from the wrenching agony that advanced and retreated lower down. I tried to focus my mind on that, to force my attention from the small, detached voice in the centre of my brain, the one saying, as though making notes on a clinical record, "You're having a hemorrhage, of course. Probably a ruptured placenta, judging from the amount of blood. Generally fatal. The loss of blood accounts for the numbness in hands and feet and the darkened vision. They say that the sense of hearing is the last to go. That seems to be true." And whether it were the last of my senses to be left to me or not, hearing I still had. And it was voices I heard, most agitated, some striving for calmness, all speaking in French. There was one word I could hear and understand. My own name, shouted over and over, but at a distance. "Claire! Claire!" "Jamie?" I tried to say, but my lips were stiff and numb with cold. Movement of any kind was beyond me. The commotion near me was settling to a steadier level. Someone had arrived who was at least willing to act as though they knew what to do. Perhaps they did. The soaked wad of my skirt was lifted gently from between my thighs, and a thick pad of cloth thrust firmly into place instead. Helpful hands turned me on to my left side and drew my knees up toward my chest. "Take her to the hospital," suggested one voice near my ear.
"She won't live that long," said another pessimistically. "Might as well wait a few minutes, then send for the meat wagon."
"No," insisted another. "The bleeding is slowing. She may live. Besides, I know her. I've seen her at l'hôpital des Anges. Take her to Mother Hildegard."
I summoned all the strength I had left and managed to whisper, "Mother." Then I gave up the struggle and let the darkness take me. Chapter 25. Raymond, the Heretic. The high vaulted ceiling over me was supported by ogives, those 14th century architectural features in which four ribs rise from the tops of pillars to join in double-crossing arches. My bed was set under one of these, gauze curtains drawn around me for privacy. The central point of the ogive wasn't directly above me, though. My bed had been placed a few feet off centre. This bothered me whenever I glanced upward. I kept wanting to move the bed by force of will, as though being centred beneath the roof would help to centre me within myself. If I had a centre any longer. My body felt bruised and tender, as though I had been beaten. My joints ached and felt loose, like teeth undermined by scurvy. Several thick blankets covered me, but they could do no more than trap heat, and I had none to save. The chill of the rainy dawn had settled in my bones. All these physical symptoms I noted objectively, as though they belonged to someone else. Otherwise, I felt nothing. The small, cold, logical centre of my brain was still there, but the envelope of feeling through which its utterances were usually filtered was gone. Dead, or paralysed, or simply no longer there. I neither knew nor cared. I had been in l'Hôpital des Anges for 5 days. Mother Hildegard's long fingers probed in relentless gentleness through the cotton of the bedgown I wore, probing the depths of my belly, seeking the hard edges of a contracting uterus. The flesh was soft as ripe fruit, though, and tender beneath her fingers. I winced as her fingers sank deep, and she frowned, muttering something under her breath that might have been a prayer. I caught a name in the murmurings and asked, "Raymond? You know Master Raymond?" I could think of few less likely pairings than this redoubtable nun and the little gnome of the Cavern of Skulls. Mother Hildegard's thick brows shot up, astonished. "Master Raymond, you say? That heretical charlatan? Que Dieu nous en garde!" "May God protect us." "Oh, I thought I heard you say Raymond."
"Ah."
The fingers had returned to their work, probing the crease of my groin in search of lumps of enlarged lymph nodes that would signal infection. They were there, I knew. I had felt them myself, moving my hands in restless misery over my empty body. I could feel the fever, an ache and a chill deep in my bones that would burst into flame when it reached the surface of my skin.
"I was invoking the aid of Saint Raymond Nonatus," Mother Hildegard explained, wringing out a cloth in cold water. "He is an aid most invaluable in the assistance of expectant mothers."
"Of which I am no longer one." I noticed remotely the brief stab of pain that creased her brows. It disappeared almost at once as she busied herself in mopping my brow, smoothing the cold water briskly over the rounds of my cheeks and down into the hot, damp creases of my neck. I shivered suddenly at the touch of the cold water, and she stopped at once, laying a considering hand on my forehead.
"Saint Raymond is not one to be picky," she said, absently reproving. "I myself take help where it can be found. A course I would recommend to you."
"Hmm." I shut my eyes, retreating into the haven of grey fog. Now there seemed to be faint lights in the fog, brief cracklings like the scatter of sheet lightning on a summer horizon. I heard the clicking of jet rosary beads as Mother Hildegard straightened up, and the soft voice of one of the sisters in the doorway, summoning her to another in the day's string of emergencies. She had almost reached the door when a thought struck her. She turned with a swish of heavy skirts, pointing at the foot of my bed with an authoritative finger.
"Bouton," she said, "au pied reste."
The dog, as unhesitating as his mistress, whirled smartly in mid-step and leapt to the foot of the bed. Once there, he took a moment to knead the bedclothes with his paws and turn 3 times widdershins, as though taking the curse off his resting place before lying down at my feet, resting his nose on his paws with a deep sigh. Satisfied, Mother Hildegard murmured, "Que Dieu vous bénisse, mon enfant," in farewell, and disappeared. Through the gathering fog and the icy numbness that wrapped me, I dimly appreciated her gesture. With no child to lay in my arms, she had given me her own best substitute. The shaggy weight on my feet was, in fact, a small bodily comfort. Bouton lay still as the dogs beneath the feet of the kings carved on the lids of their tombs at Saint-Denis, his warmth denying the marble chill of my feet, his presence an improvement on either solitude or the company of humans, as he required nothing of me. Nothing was precisely what I felt and all I had to give. Bouton emitted a small, popping dog fart and settled into sleep.
I drew the covers over my nose and tried to do likewise. I slept, eventually. And I dreamed. Fever dreams of weariness and desolation, of an impossible task done endlessly. Unceasing, painful effort carried out in a stony, barren place. Of thick grey fog through which loss pursued me like a demon in the mist.
I woke, quite suddenly, to find that Bouton was gone, but I wasn't alone. Raymond's hairline was completely level, the flat line drawn across the wide brow as though with a rule. He wore his thick greying hair swept back and hanging straight to the shoulder, so the massive forehead protruded like a block of stone, completely overshadowing the rest of his face. It hovered over me now, looking to my fevered eyes like the slab of a tombstone. The lines and furrows moved slightly as he spoke to the sisters, and I thought they seemed like letters written just below the surface of the stone, trying to burrow their way to the surface so that the name of the dead could be read. I was convinced that in another moment my name would be legible on that white slab, and at that moment I would truly die. I arched my back and screamed.
"Now, see there! She doesn't want you, you disgusting old creature. You're disturbing her rest. Come away at once."
Mother Hildegard clutched Raymond imperatively by the arm, tugging him away from the bed. He resisted, standing rooted like a stone gnome in a lawn. But Sister Celeste added her not inconsiderable efforts to Mother Hildegard's, and they lifted him clean off his feet and bore him away between them, the clog dropping from one frantically kicking foot as they went. The clog lay where it had fallen, on its side, square in the centre of a scrubbed flagstone. With the intense fixation of fever, I was unable to take my eyes off it. I traced the impossibly smooth curve of the worn edge over and over, each time pulling back my gaze from the impenetrable darkness of the inside. If I let myself enter that blackness, my soul would be sucked out into chaos. As my eyes rested on it, I could hear again the sounds of the time passage through the circle of stones, and I flung out my arms, clutching frantically at the wadded bedding, seeking some anchorage against confusion. Suddenly, an arm shot through the draperies, and a work-reddened hand snatched up the shoe and disappeared. Deprived of focus, my heat-addled mind spun round the grooves of the flags for a time, then, soothed by the geometric regularity, turned inward and wobbled into sleep like a dying top. There was no stillness in my dreams, though, and I stumbled wearily through mazes of repeating figures, endless loopings and whorls. It was with a sense of profound relief that I saw at last the irregularities of a human face. And an irregular face it was, to be sure, screwed up as it was in a ferocious frown, lips pursed in adjuration. It was only as I felt the pressure of the hand over my mouth that I realized I was no longer asleep. The long, lipless mouth of a gargoyle hovered next to my ear.
"Be still, ma chère. If they find me here again, I'm done for."
The large dark eyes darted from side to side, keeping watch for any movement of the drapes.
I nodded slowly, and he released my mouth, his fingers leaving a faint whiff of ammonium and sulphur behind. He had somewhere found, or stolen, I thought dimly, a ragged grey friar's gown to cover the grimy velvet of his apothecary's robe, and the depths of the hood concealed both the telltale silver hair and that monstrous forehead. The fever delusions receded slightly, displaced by what remnants of curiosity remained to me. I was too weak to say more than, "What?" when he placed a finger once more across my lips and threw back the sheet covering me. I watched in some bemusement as he rapidly unknotted the strings of my shift and opened the garment to the waist. His movements were swift and businesslike, completely lacking in lechery. Not that I could imagine anyone capable of trying to ravish a fever-racked carcass like mine, particularly not within hearing of Mother Hildegard, but still. I watched with remote fascination as he placed his cupped hands on my breasts. They were broad and almost square, the fingers all of a length, with unusually long and supple thumbs that curved around my breast with amazing delicacy. Watching them, I had an unusually vivid memory of Marion Jenkinson, a girl with whom I had trained at Pembroke Hospital, telling the rapt inmates of the nurses' quarters that the size and shape of a man's thumbs were a sure indication of the quality of his more intimate appendage. "And it's true, I swear it," Marion would declare, shaking back her blonde hair dramatically. But when pressed for examples, she would only giggle and dimple, rolling her eyes toward Lieutenant Hanley, who strongly resembled a gorilla, opposable and sizable thumbs notwithstanding. The large thumbs were pressing gently but firmly into my flesh, and I could feel my swollen nipples rising against the hard palms, cold by comparison with my own heated skin. "Jamie," I said, and a shiver passed over me.
"Hush, Madonna," said Raymond.
His voice was low, kind, but somehow abstracted, as though he were paying no attention to me, in spite of what he was doing. The shiver came back. It was as though the heat passed from me to him, but his hands didn't warm. His fingers stayed cool, and I chilled and shook as the fever ebbed and flowed, draining from my bones. The afternoon light was dim through the thick gauze of the drapes around my bed, and Raymond's hands were dark on the white flesh of my breasts. The shadows between the thick, grimy fingers were not black, though. They were blue, I thought. I closed my eyes, looking at the party-coloured swirl of patterns that immediately appeared behind my lids. When I opened them again, it was as though something of the colour remained behind, coating Raymond's hands. As the fever ebbed, leaving my mind clearer, I blinked, trying to raise my head for a better look. Raymond pressed slightly harder, urging me to lie back, and I let my head fall on the pillow, peering slantwise over my chest. I wasn't imagining it after all. Or was I? While Raymond's hands weren't moving themselves, a faint flicker of coloured light seemed to move over them, shedding a glow of rose and a pallor of blue across my own white skin. My breasts were warming now, but warming with the natural heat of health, not the gnawing burn of fever. The draught from the open archway outside found a way through the drapes and lifted the damp hair at my temples, but I wasn't chilled now. Raymond's head was bent, face hidden by the cowl of his borrowed robe. After what seemed a long time, he moved his hands from my breasts, very slowly over my arms, pausing and squeezing gently at the joints of shoulder and elbow, wrists and fingers. The soreness eased, and I thought I could see briefly a faint blue line within my upper arm, the glowing ghost of the bone. Always touching, never hurrying, he brought his hands back over the shallow curve of my collarbone and down the meridian of my body, splaying his palms across my ribs. The oddest thing about all this was that I wasn't at all astonished. It seemed an infinitely natural thing, and my tortured body relaxed gratefully into the hard mould of his hands, melting and reforming like moulded wax. Only the lines of my skeleton held firm. An odd feeling of warmth now emanated from those broad, square workman's hands. They moved with painstaking slowness over my body, and I could feel the tiny deaths of the bacteria that inhabited my blood, small explosions as each scintilla of infection disappeared. I could feel each interior organ, complete and three-dimensional, and see it as well, as though it sat on a table before me. There, the hollow-walled stomach. Here, the lobed solidness of my liver, and each convolution and twist of intestine turned in and on and around itself, neatly packed in the shining web of its mesentery membrane. The warmth glowed and spread within each organ, illuminating it like a small sun within me, then died and moved on. Raymond paused, hands pressed side by side on my swollen belly. I thought he frowned, but it was hard to tell. The cowled head turned, listening, but the usual noises of the hospital continued in the distance, with no warning heel-taps coming our way. I gasped and moved involuntarily as one hand moved lower, cupped briefly between my legs. An increase in pressure from the other hand warned me to be silent, and the blunt fingers eased their way inside me. I closed my eyes and waited, feeling my inner walls adjust to this odd intrusion, the inflammation subsiding bit by bit as he probed gently deeper. Now he touched the centre of my loss, and a spasm of pain contracted the heavy walls of my inflamed uterus. I breathed a small moan, then clamped my lips as he shook his head. The other hand slid down to rest comfortingly on my belly as the groping fingers of the other touched my womb. He was still then, holding the source of my pain between his two hands, as though it were a sphere of crystal, heavy and fragile.
"Now," he said softly, "call him. Call the red man. Call him."
The pressure of the fingers within and the palm without grew harder, and I pressed my legs against the bed, fighting it. But there was no strength left in me to resist, and the inexorable pressure went on, cracking the crystal sphere, freeing the chaos within. My mind filled with images, worse than the misery of the fever dreams, because more real. Grief and loss and fear racked me, and the dusty scent of death and white chalk filled my nostrils. Casting about in the random patterns of my mind for help, I heard the voice still muttering, patiently but firmly,
"Call him."
And I sought my anchor. "Jamie! Jamie!" A bolt of heat shot through my belly, from one hand to the other, like an arrow through the centre of the basin of my bones. The pressing grip relaxed, slid free, and the lightness of harmony filled me. The bed frame quivered as he ducked beneath it, barely in time. "Milady, are you all right?" Sister Angelique shoved through the drapes, round-faced, creased with worry beneath her wimple. The concern in her eyes was underlaid with resignation. The sisters knew I would die soon. If this looked to be my last struggle, she was prepared to summon the priest. Her small, hard hand rested briefly against my cheek, moved quickly to my brow, then back. The sheet still lay crumpled around my thighs, and my gown lay open. Her hand slid inside it into my armpits, where they remained for a moment before withdrawing. "God be praised," she cried, eyes moistening. "The fever is gone." She bent close, peering in sudden alarm, to be sure that the disappearance of the fever wasn't due to the fact that I was dead. I smiled at her weakly. "I'm all right," I said. "Tell mother." She nodded eagerly, and pausing only long enough to draw the sheet modestly over me, she hurried from the room. The drapes had hardly swung closed behind her when Raymond emerged from under the bed.
"I must go," he said.
He laid a hand upon my head.
"Be well, Madonna."
Weak as I was, I rose up, grasping his arm. I slid my hand up the length of forged tough muscle, seeking but not finding. The smoothness of his skin was unblemished, clear to the crest of the shoulder. He stared down at me in astonishment.
"What are you doing, Madonna?"
"Nothing." I sank back, disappointed. I was too weak and too light-headed to be careful of my words. "I wanted to see whether you had a vaccination scar."
"Vaccination?"
Skilled as I was at reading faces by now, I would have seen the slightest twitch of comprehension, no matter how swiftly it was concealed. But there was none. "Why do you call me Madonna still?" I asked. My hands rested on the slight concavity of my stomach, gently, as though not to disturb the shattering emptiness. "I've lost my child." He looked mildly surprised.
"Ah, I did not call you Madonna because you were with child, my lady.
Why then? I didn't really expect him to answer, but he did. Tired and